Today's guest is Heather Rivera, and I met Heather on the other side of the world. She was one of the participants in the retreat that I just went on in March in Thailand. And, you know, sometimes you meet a person and you just connect. Her story was so interesting. I just had to have her on the podcast. She fit the bill in terms of somebody not only who is in her second half, but has a life of pivoting. Lots of different things that she's done that have lit her up. A lot of challenges, a lot of obstacles she's faced. She was raised in a cult. We talk about that. She was addicted to drugs and alcohol after she left the cult. As you can imagine, living and being raised by members of a cult can do a number on your head. But she found her way. And in the process, she found who Heather really is. And she is a wonderful human. We have a lot in common. I've made a lot of pivots myself. I was not raised in a cult, although my parents were nudists. I don't know if you've heard that story, but that's a whole nother topic. But yeah, we had a lot in common. And one of the things that I really connected with her on is that she has a passion for something. And she built a business on this passion, which I did too. And our passions are different, but we both went all in on our passion and found that we weren't able to make ends meet financially with that passion. So we had to pivot. And we have done so very successfully. And in a way, the common ground that we found, which we talk about, is that we finally were at peace, I believe, with whatever unfolds. I believe that when you get to the age that we are and you've done a lot of work on yourself, you come to realize what feels right and you don't try to force things as much as you did in the past. We've learned a lot about ourselves along the long and winding paths that we have walked. And I thought that Heather's story was one that would resonate, is one that perhaps you can relate to because you may have walked in some of these same ways. You might have walked in the world in many of the same ways that Heather has done. And she is a light and she is doing great work in the world in the job that she's in now. And she is still thriving in her passion without the pressure, which is wonderful. The place we should all be is being able to have a passion that doesn't give us pressure. And we can still be lit up in who we are and how we provide value in the world. So without further ado, let's tune in to my conversation with Heather Rivera. Welcome to another episode of Living Your Sparked Second Half podcast. And I am very excited to have this conversation today. In fact, we've been talking for probably about 20 minutes before I press record, but I have a guest, Heather Rivera, and I met her on my recent retreat to Thailand. So she's an adventurer like me. She's crazy like me. And you've also did two retreats with the same person like
before
me, right?
This one, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so welcome.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be with you.
And she's also a podcast episode virgin. So this is
yes.
Yes. I'm her first.
Yes. 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 So. You are absolutely popping my podcast cherry for sure.
Yes. Yes. I haven't heard that term for a long time. Gosh. So yeah, when we talked a lot while we were on the retreat, of course, but as the week went on, of course, you get more in depth with people. And Heather has the most interesting story. Not only does she have an interesting upbringing, which we might not even get to, I might have to have you back to talk about that whole thing. But the thing that struck me that I thought would, that you as a listener would like to hear, there's so much in Heather's story where she followed her heart and she did something that she really wanted to do, that she was passionate about it, but yet it didn't pay the bills and she had to do something else. And it really resonated with me when we had that conversation because I had the same thing happen to me. And where I think I want to start with you, Heather, is I think this happens to a lot of people. Either they're afraid to leave the job that is sucking the life out of them to do what they're passionate about, so they don't ever go there, or they go and do it and they aren't making ends meet. And then they think, oh my God, I cannot go back to what I did before because it's going to suck the soul out of me. And so they think there's this like one option or maybe no options when there's so many options, and you found happiness and you actually love two things that you're doing. So let's start there. I just want to know, first of all, what were you doing when you made this decision? How did you, first of all, find out about your passion?
That's a great question. As you were talking, I'm like, oh my goodness, where am I even going to begin? I don't even know, because there are so many times in my life. Well, let's rewind. So I grew up in a way that did not encourage my connection to myself and who I am. I was raised to believe that my gut instincts were wrong, that everything that I thought first was wrong. And so that has kind of followed me, not so much anymore. I mean, it's still there, but it doesn't at all control me the way that it used to. So,
and can I ask you, how did that show up? How was that teaching in a way that you probably didn't know at the time, but
no,
as you got older and you started to get wise about?
Well, I was raised, I mean, I don't know how much we want to get into my childhood, but I was raised in a cult, basically, that, don't mind the pen, I like to hold it, it helps me think. I was raised in a cult that basically said, there is no possible way for you to ever please God, but you should try really hard. And God will be even more displeased if you don't try really hard. So I was kind of set up for failure. And everyone in the church was also set up for failure because you could never actually meet those expectations. And the expectations weren't even really clear. So I really lived in a place for many years until I left the cult at 21. I was born into it and I left it when I was 21. So I lived in a world where I felt trapped and I felt like I didn't have a choice, which, like, not everybody grew up in a cult, but I do know that most people, especially women, feel trapped and feel like they don't have choices in many, many places. I don't know, maybe men feel that way, but I'm not a man. So,
and did you feel like you were always being, like, there was constant microscope, like you were constantly being judged by the greater power?
Goodness. Yeah, absolutely. Not only did I feel like I was constantly being judged, I was taught that my parents were an extension of God. So the hierarchy of the universe was God, Jesus Christ, and this guy who had founded our church, who was like God's apostle and all of that. And then my parents, you know, were under the ministers and all of that. And I was like this peon in the grand scheme of the universe. And so,
and since they were instruments of God, then whatever they wanted. So that, I'm trying to get at, like, so how did you know it wasn't, like, you couldn't be who you were and your authentic self?
I didn't know at the time. I mean, I just knew that something was profoundly wrong with me. Something was profoundly wrong with what, like, when I was a child, I remember so many things, being taught so many things and thinking, that's not right. That's not right. But I wasn't capable at the time, or I wasn't willing or whatever to actually allow that thought to form. Yeah. But in hindsight, I realized that thought kept coming. This isn't right. This isn't right. This doesn't make sense. I mean, even, you know, when I was probably about 8 or 9, I remember asking my mom, like, but how do we know we're the chosen ones, mom? How do we know that? And she couldn't give me an answer. Anytime I couldn't get an answer to something that didn't make sense to me, I didn't have faith I didn't have strong enough faith. I needed to do more studying. I needed to look in the Bible. I needed to, you know, whatever. And so basically, anytime I had like common sense that contradicted whatever I was being taught, that was shut down, and it was told that it was inspired by Satan and maybe I was going to get possessed by a demon or whatever. So there was, you know, there was a lot of stuff like that. So you can imagine how that impacted me. I know not everybody has that kind of, you know, super religious, intense stuff pushed on them. But I think everybody, to a certain extent, is raised in a way that is counterintuitive for them.
Yes.
That like, when they get older, they realize who they are and they look back and they're like, oh, I wasn't really able to be myself at all. And so your question, how did that manifest? I mean, do you mean how did it manifest in me or how did it?
Yeah, I just thought a specific teaching or comment or lesson that you got from your childhood. I think you gave a really good example. Like, I think being judged by the people that you look up to and admire and wanting mm-hmm. to please them and whatever their suggestions are for you become your path.
Yeah.
And well, so and it's, thing, yeah. And it might not be aligned with what you feel is right for you, but you're not going to question it because you're looking to these guides, your people in your life.
Absolutely.
And whether they're religious or whether they're not religious, it can turn out the same way where you just are detached from who you're supposed to be in the world.
Yeah, I think it's still just as impactful. I mean, you know, religious or not, your parents are very impactful, no matter what. I think the other really big thing that impacted me was the role of women in the church. I was taught that women are the weaker vessel and that, like, my mother wasn't allowed to work. We gave 30% of our income to the church. Well, 30% of my father's gross income to the church, and then we paid taxes. So I basically grew up in poverty. My mother wasn't allowed to work until many, many years later. And so there was a lot of like women have very specific jobs and they are not outside the home. And so it's fascinating because when I look at my life today, like I have an amazing job. I make great money. I'm single. I'm delighted to be single. I live in two places. I live in Los Angeles most of the time. And then I live in Florida, like a quarter of the time with my dad, who's 86. I mean, I am like the man of the house now, for sure, if such a thing were to be. But I also have never been as feminine as I am right now. And so I look back at the way that I was raised as far as like what women's roles are. And I'm like, it's night and day. I can't believe it. When I really think, when I hold up the contrast, it's like, I can't believe that I get to be this person when I was raised to be something entirely different. Because, and perhaps we'll talk about this another time, but I mean, I even went to the college that was affiliated with my church to find a husband so that I could be a minister's wife, which obviously didn't end up happening. But that's what I was taught. That was the track that I was meant to go down. That's what God wanted for me. And so when I left, at the age of 21, in hindsight, I see that this is one of the most magical experiences I've ever had. At the time, it was incredibly traumatic. And I guess both of those things can be true. But when I left the church, it was because they had changed their doctrines. And so I had grown up believing one set, kind of believing. I mean, I didn't really ever buy into it, but it's all I knew. So I believed that that's what it was. And there was just something wrong with me. But I was raised to believe this one set of principles. And then when they changed their doctrines, they completely did a 180 and shifted everything. And so I was like, you mean to tell me for 21 years, I did all of these things, but really I only had to do these? Like I didn't, I was pretty pissed. That when I left the church, it allowed me, like everything that I believed was completely swept off the table. It was like a clean slate. And so I decided I was going to do all the bad things right then, like immediately. And I really did. So many things happened and I put myself in so many dangerous situations as a result of that. Like I was hell-bent on a path of self-destruction deliberately. It was purposeful. That was probably the biggest turning point in my life because everything that I believed had been taken away. And so I was left on like the precipice of emptiness. What is the meaning of anything? I mean, I didn't know. And so I can tell you, I was 21 then, and I'm going to be 50 this year. So ever since I left the church, and I have definitely gone all over the place on my path, but ever since I left the church, my belief system, I built it from the ground up, and it's based on my own experience. And perhaps I glean things from other people about what they say that they believe in. If it doesn't work for me, I don't take it. But if it does work for me, I take it and I internalize it because it's my experience and I know. And that's why my favorite topic in the world is how there is value and opportunity in all things. That's like my favorite thing to talk about ever because it is so true for me. It is so true for me. There is so much value in growing up in a cult. Did it suck? Yes. Was I absolutely abused? Yes. Did really bad things happen? Yes. Do I wish it on anybody? No. However, it really enables me to provide people, not just people who have experienced religious abuse, but anybody who is disconnected from who they are. I get that. I get that 100%. And there are ways around it. There are ways not around it, actually. There are ways through it, always through it. And so that the value
going through it is where you've got to have the breakthrough. Yes.
That's the only way. It's the only way. And it's not fun. And it takes a really long time. But that's what happened with the career thing. So
can I ask you, I have a question. When do you think you knew, and I think you think like I do too, in terms of we're always evolving, but when do you think you really knew who Heather was?
That is another excellent question. And there are many phases to that. So of course, I feel like I'm more me than I've ever been. There was a very long period of time where I only very slightly knew who I was. And I felt like I was far too fucked up to ever live a normal life, to ever have a happy relationship, to ever interact with people in a comfortable way. I never thought I was going to be able to move through the world in a way that was productive and happy. I didn't think that. I mean, I became an alcoholic and a drug addict after I left the church because why not, right? Like that's, that was definitely
the trajectory. You didn't like the person who you thought you were. And that's how a lot of people deal with it, right?
Yes, absolutely. So I've now been sober. What year is it? 24. So this year I'll be celebrating 24 years of sobriety because I got sober in 2000. So that also plays a huge role. That was another massive turning point, which probably is beyond the scope of this particular episode. But the value and opportunity thing, it all comes back to that. So when I think of my trajectory, my career trajectory, if you want to call it that, when I first started working, I didn't have a work ethic. Like I didn't know how to work. I had never been taught how to work. I think my parents tried. My father has an amazing work ethic. My mother never really worked. So I didn't know that I could do things that I didn't feel like doing. I was also an only child. And while I wasn't spoiled with things, I was spoiled with attention. I was like the center of my family. And so that's a whole evolution in itself, discovering how to have a work ethic. But once I discovered a work ethic, well, like fast forward, I went to college. I went to college after the Christian cult college, and I have various degrees in the social work, family studies, psychology. And then I actually got my master's degree in education, instructional design. So I worked in all of those fields a little bit here and there, and I learned how to work, but I thought that helping people would make my soul sing, and it did, but it was also really exhausting. I worked in AIDS as a social worker for about 10 years. And this was during it was right at the tail end of when everybody was dying. So it was very intense. And I loved the work, but I also was incredibly young and immature. And I really took so much stuff personally. Like if my clients would do things that I knew to be bad for them, I would take that personally. I would internalize it and I would take it home with me. Whereas it would have been healthier to just detach and be like, okay, well, here's what I can offer you. Take it or leave it, which is how I am now. But that is not how I was when I was actually being a social worker. So after 10 years, I had to stop.
Yeah, I think that's the form of helping people that when you get in too deep, it ends up harming you, right? Because you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. And so you ultimately don't feel you're helping them, I think.
You're not helping them. You're not helping them at all. I was constantly trying to push the horse's head into the water, and the horse is like, not happening. So yeah, it's not helping them. But
so when did you find out your love of, because you make the most beautiful jewelry and your background, I don't know if you ever dabbled or you like to wear jewelry or how it let, how did you, so many people struggle to find what they're passionate about. And what I try to encourage people to do is experiment with as many different things as they can. And try something, and if you don't like it, don't do it again. But you have to take action and try things to see what lights you up. So how did you know that you would love jewelry so much, and that not only do you love it, and I think anything that you love, some things require skill, but you can, if you love it, you can build the skill and you can learn new skills at any age. And some people just are gifted at things naturally, but you clearly, I mean, I've seen your work and it's amazing. So you're passionate about it. You clearly have done it long enough. I don't know if you were gifted at it initially, but you got to have an eye for it, and you can teach, you can learn that as well too. But how did that come about?
First, Lori, I want to say that, like, my philosophy that everyone should experiment with all the things, I totally buy into that. That's mine as well. But how did I know that jewelry or making jewelry was my passion? I didn't. I didn't know really that I was creative until I was 10 years sober, because I had been raised in a way to not, don't explore that stuff that's in there. That's how you open up to Satan. Don't explore it. Keep it tamped down. Like, that is the way I was raised, to don't address that stuff because that is very dangerous. And so the way that I operate now is, oh, pull every thread and see what comes out. So when I was 10 years sober, I don't remember exactly what happens, but I started making stuff again. And then when I started making stuff, you know, I would go to like the craft store and I would get stuff and I would play around and I'd be like, ooh, what if I did this? And what if I did that? And I started pumping out all of this jewelry. And as I was doing that, as my creative juices started to flow, I looked back over my life and I realized I can't remember a time where I wasn't actually making something. I'm always making something, always. When I was a teenager, I was making those string bracelets, or like a preteen, you know, like those macrame. I did tons of macrame. I learned how to knit and crochet, and I was constantly knitting and crocheting all the way through college. I was always making something, but I didn't equate that with being an artist. I always wanted to be an artist. I thought that that was the most romantic thing in the world, but I was like, I could never be one. I mean, that's so far outside of the realm of possibility for me, because I'm just this little female Christian person that has to do this. And so once, when I was 21 and all of that kind of exploded and shattered and left me raw, with all of these limitless choices, both good and bad, everything was off the table and everything was up for grabs. And so I think that that's something that can happen to people who don't have to leave cults when they're 21 too. Like, I think that people can do it by decision. I am going to examine all of it and decide what, like taking inventory in a business. This sells a lot. I should keep this. This has never sold a single thing. Is there any reason for me to keep it? No. And so I did that with like my characteristics and how I am and my history. And that clarified so many things for me. It made me see who I am, you know, the good, the bad, the indecent, all of it.
So you took personal inventory of your characteristics. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes. And it really sucked. The process was incredibly painful,
because I would think that you'd also be where you were coming from, and hopefully, I don't know, was this part of your getting sober process?
It is part of that process, but it's a part of any recovery process, really. Yeah. Like taking stock of what's actually happening. So when I did it, it helped me to see beyond the stories that I was telling myself about myself. Because most of the stories that I have ever told about myself are false. Either they are incredibly grandiose, or they are so far off, you know, the rails about what a piece of crap I am. You know what I mean? That they're never they're never accurate, the stories. And so to look at those and be like, okay, one of my greatest gifts is communication. I used to use that gift for my own gain all the time to harm other people. I mean, I can really say some things in the moment that can cause a lot of damage to people. And that is me using my gift. It's not a gift. It's not a curse. It's a characteristic I learned. If I just look at everything about me as a characteristic and determine how to turn it on its head and use it for good, use it for the highest good of everyone around me, communication. I mean, that's what I'm doing right now.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I was going to ask you that, because I would be afraid that somebody who is taking inventory of their characteristics, that they would label some bad. And so I'm glad that you said you can take something that you might have viewed as bad or in a certain situation as bad and flip it into a positive, and the way you can use that characteristic for good. So that is excellent. I love that. So your inventory doesn't have to be like bad and good, but it's like instances maybe environmentally where it maybe showed up in a negative way, a non-serving way.
Yeah, I thank you so much for making that clarification. And I think that is a hugely important distinction to make, that in my opinion, all personal inventories should be looked at as though there is no bad. There is no bad. There is only serves me and others and doesn't serve me and others.
Yep.
Not good, not bad, because good and bad, the connotations, I mean, there's nothing inherently wrong with the words, but the connotations are so deep and intense. And probably most of us have, you know, attachments to the word in some way. So either serves me and others or does not serve me and others. And I think that every characteristic can fall into either one of the, into one or both of those categories, even. We just need to determine how best to utilize them. And I think that's the biggest shift that I had personally, because I'm sure you would imagine, have learned how to say really mean things to myself as well. Mm. I was raised to do that. I was raised to believe that I could never live up, that I was fundamentally flawed. But come to find out, that's actually not true.
Yeah. Yeah. This is so good. So you described your path as a very meandering, you know, trying, and from your description of your different degrees and skill sets, jobs, et cetera, you have done a lot of different things. So I can imagine when jewelry became this passion, this newfound passion of yours, and deciding to go all in with that, it was just another meandering way to follow what you thought was right at the time. It sounds like it wasn't really a big decision, but you had a job that was well paid. And so walk me through that.
It was a huge decision, actually, because it was accompanied by moving to Florida with my dad. So I was, the older I get, the less grasp on time that I have. I don't know exactly how old I was, but it was a while ago. I was working in a school and I was doing, my job title was special projects manager, which means all the crap that nobody else wants to do. And I was really good at it. And it paid pretty well. So I was in that job. And then my dad had moved. I was living in Ohio at the time. My dad had moved to Ohio. He and my mom got a divorce several years before he moved to Ohio. He was like late 70s at the time, like 78, 79. So it was about 10, 12 years ago. And he spent one winter in Ohio. He moved from New Jersey and he was getting older. He spent one winter in Ohio. I was like, I can't winter anymore. And I had been vacationing in Captiva, Florida, for several years, like every winter. And so I was like, Daddy, I know just the place, not Captiva, because I can't buy, you know, a $3 million home. But we did buy a duplex in Cape Coral, which is kind of in between Sanibel, Captiva, and like Fort Myers, which is the main airport area there. We bought a duplex in Cape Coral, and he lived on one side and I live on the other, which actually is still the case.
I love now, that.
Which, by the way, I recommend that arrangement to anybody, because I know you love your parents, but you probably don't want to live with them.
So, you just knock on the wall.
So, yes, exactly. I check in with him once a day. I moved in a roommate who is also a caretaker for my dad. So that's how I can be here in LA most of the time, which is where I really want to be. But of course, you know, I love being with my dad. I just like to come back here as well. Yeah. So anyway, we bought a duplex, we moved to Florida, and I had been making jewelry quite a bit by then. I had been doing like art shows here and there. I hadn't really, I had a website. I was kind of making it happen, not in a big way, but it was happening. And then my dad said, I don't want to winter. And I was like, I've been looking at the shells down there because shelling in Southwest Florida is absolutely amazing. I've been looking at the shells. I'm going to quit my job. We're going to buy a house. I'm going to make shell jewelry. And that's what I did. My father told me later, he was like, I was like, I thought it was a pie in the sky. And I was like, you know what? So did I. But there was just, I mean, the way that I looked at it, that whole cult thing, leaving the cult, being so structured, and then everything is taken off the table, and me having to really just suddenly at 21 years old, like, oh my goodness, what is my purpose in the world? What's my place? What choices do I make? How do I move through the world? That opened things up for me, like I was a funnel for the universe. It is fascinating how it happened. I can't even really describe it, but that kind of shift, like making, I didn't make the decision. I'm grateful that it happened for me, that I was standing at the precipice of emptiness and I had to fill that with something. That opened me up to, well, I got through that craziness and I'm a lot better off now than I was then. So I'm going to try it and see what happens, because I know I can wait tables. I know that I can figure something out. I know that I'm not going to starve. I'm not going to let my dad starve. I'm going to figure it out. I know I will. And I don't know why I had that, like, I know I will, but I wasn't wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, I fell flat on my face with doing the jewelry full time. I did it for 5 years and it was amazing. I got involved with a local co-op, an artist co-op, where we had a gallery. I'm still part of it actually, but that I sold my stuff. I had a huge, like, you know, a case and like shelves and all the things for my jewelry. And I did really well for what it was, but I wasn't able to make a living. I had a website. I had multiple websites. I had all the things. And I thought that if I could just work hard enough, I could make it happen. And that belief that if I could just work hard enough, that was almost my undoing. Mm-hmm. Because that's not the way it happens.
Right.
So my crash,
you're gonna end up back in not sober.
yes yeah. Exactly. In fact, I came this close, honestly. Mm-hmm. The crash and burn happened when it was before I ended up hooking up with this gallery that I'm still a part of. I had my jewelry in various stores, you know, in downtown Fort Myers and some galleries here and there. And I had just left, I wasn't really selling, and I had just left the store in downtown Fort Myers, and I wanted to take my stuff out because it wasn't selling, and I had to pay the rent on the space for the previous month because I was late. And so I wrote two checks, one from my business checking account and one from my personal checking account, and that cleared both of them out empty to pay that rent and to get my stuff and to leave. And I just left there sobbing in my car.
Aww.
Because I had no money. I had no prospects, really. I didn't know what I was going to do. That's when I started waiting tables, which kind of saved the day.
Wow.
And I was like, well, I know I can wait tables. So I did.
Yeah. I did that in the day. I could probably do it again.
If we have to. Yeah. I mean, I really prefer not to, but you know what? In a pinch.
Yeah. And you have pretty jewelry to wear.
Yes, exactly. And I was always hustling. I was wearing my jewelry. I was trying to sell it. I was working at a diner. I mean, like, people in a diner generally don't have like lots of money but anyway, I was working it. I was just grinding and spinning my wheels. And even after I connected with this gallery co-op and it was fantastic and I was still selling, it wasn't enough. I mean, the cost of living just goes up. And what the thing about being a maker, about making things that people will buy, you spend all of this time and energy and money and blood, sweat, and tears into making this piece, and you have no guarantee that anyone's ever going to buy it.
Right.
No guarantee. Even if you have like an arrangement with it, there's no guarantee. Being an artist is an incredibly challenging profession. to make a living at. And also it took away from my joy in creating.
Right.
So when I was making this stuff, I was like, okay, but look, it's beautiful. Someone will want it. Someone will buy it. That's no way to live. So I finally, a friend of mine works in finance, and she said one of my, she wasn't even a colleague. It was kind of like she inadvertently knew this person from wherever, they had like a client in common. And she introduced me to Jan, who you met on our retreat. And I thought that I was just going to ask Jan in finance, of all things. I'm humanities, I'm social work, I'm education.
Yeah.
But Jan is in finance. And I was like, you know what? I can figure it out. I would love to work for you for like a year, maybe two. And then this was 2019. Jan hired me, and I immediately saw that it was a perfect fit for me somehow. I finance, of all things. So our firm does, we provide administrative support to financial advisors all over the US. We're virtual, 100% remote. It is a fantastic firm. I'm now the director of operations. It was just me and Jan when I started, and it's 2024 now, and we now have 25 people as of today. And here's the thing, I make enough money and my schedule is flexible enough for me to do my jewelry whenever I want, for me to live on two coasts, and for me to travel. I was just in Thailand with you. I mean,
yeah, it's great.
This is the shift in me being willing, okay, I got to do something. I've got to feed my dad and my dog, like, and I should probably eat too. The willingness to do whatever it took, but also shifting away from if I can just work hard enough, because I wasn't, there is no way to work hard enough to make that happen. I didn't have the structure in place to make it happen. There is a lot of time and energy, and I don't even have that fully set up yet for my jewelry business, but I can take my time right now. I mean, I've rolled out a number of collections and they have done well. My website's still up. I still have stuff in the gallery. What I really want to do, part of the reason that I moved to LA, aside from the fact that Los Angeles has this, like, I don't even know how to explain it, this like eclectic, carefree vitality that I have never seen anywhere else. And I love it. But aside from that, the jewelry that I'm making now is so expensive for Southwest Florida. I mean, it just really is. And so I was like, well, I love Los Angeles. I have lots of people in Los Angeles that I love, and people there, some of them will be able to afford my jewelry. So I'm going to go there. And that's what I'm doing. I'm in the background. I'm creating this jewelry kind of whenever I can, which ends up being almost every day. Like, I'm spending all kinds of time. Like right now I'm making myself, the other thing, I'm sorry, I'm shifting. See, this is meander. My conversations meander. Please stop me.
I like it because your things are coming to you, and I like it just unfolding. As I said, it's just unfolding. I have questions building up though. So
yes, please ask your questions, because I get really excited and I'm like, ooh, shiny things. Like, even I don't know what I'm going to say. So please ask your questions.
So one thing that I think a listener might be curious about is, what do you think shifted about you? You got rid of the work hard mentality. I guess the question would be, how did you do that? And what was it? Because one of the things that I've had a hard time with in my life, and I noticed that when I stop doing it, things come so much easier for me, is I tend to try to force things. You know, I'm like trying to, I make a decision too fast, or I try to force something that it's just not ready. You know, it's not fully baked or something. And it could come down to the decision-making process. I took a class in human design, and I learned what my chart was. And it was really interesting, because what the chart said about me was that I am the type of person, my human design is that I'm supposed to get, you know, like make the request I want, basically, mentally. Say it out loud, or you can just say it quietly to your, so your brain knows and the universe knows. And then you just wait. You wait. I'm not a patient person. I am not a patient person. I'm going to go after it. I'm going to go get it. And if you think about it that way too, that's kind of the work hard mentality, right? Just go, go, go. And it's hard for me to sit in stillness, and it's hard for me to be okay to just let it unfold. And it's almost like you went and waitressed, and then this amazing job opportunity came, which on the surface didn't look so great since it was so different from what you've done, didn't seem very aligned. And you've just killed it with Jan and helping her grow her business. So I'm just curious if that, what shifted in you that you think happened?
Well, I think it's really very much, very much like what you just described. So the idea of, if I can just work hard enough, just to give an example, you remember on the retreat, I got sick, or not very sick, but I had like a tickle in the back of my throat. I was coughing a little bit, you know. Historically, I would push myself anyway to go to all the things and do all the activities and be everything to all the people and make all the people like me and whatever, which, I mean, sure, if that's a thing that you actually are, but that's not who I am. I'm actually an introvert. I mean, get me talking, obviously, and I'll just keep going, but I'm an introvert and I need my time. And also, I'm sick. If I were looking at somebody else and they had a tickle in their throat and they weren't feeling well, I'd be like, honey, it's fine. You don't have to force yourself, like, go lie down. But for me, I have to drive through. My standards for myself are so much higher than my standards for other people, first of all. And then the other thing is that,
which is, I'm glad you brought up that example because you bounced right back. I mean, I thought you were down for the count. I thought, oh my God, she's probably going to be sick the rest of the week. And you really were only down that day. And then the next day you were there and you seemed to be pretty normal the rest of the time.
That is exactly because I have learned, I was able to keep myself healthy enough. You notice I didn't go snorkeling and I didn't go on whatever the other excursion was. And I deliberately didn't go on those because I knew that it would just make me sicker and I was going to relax, maybe get a couple of massages, a couple of $7 massages and just, you know, drink lots of fluid, be healthy. I was able to enjoy the retreat as much as I possibly could. And that's, I had to make a decision. With my finite resources and energy, I had to decide where that energy and time and focus was best spent. And that's why if I could just work hard enough, doesn't work, because you're just pushing really hard at something that may or may not move. Strategy is important. And sometimes it's not possible to see the whole picture. But for example, in Thailand, I know myself and my body well enough that it's going to need extra sleep, that I will feel okay more than I don't feel okay. And so I'm going to take measures to make that as much as possible. And also, I don't want to get anybody else sick. And so I was able to, and thank you for saying that, because that was my goal, to participate as much as possible without causing myself big damage, which I was able to do. And so that's kind of how I approach work. That's how we are at Voss, which is my firm. We preach work-life balance. We really, really do, because we want your best. And the only way that we're going to get your best is if you're taking care of yourself. And if that means taking a nap in the middle of your workday, take a nap in the middle of your workday. So that's how I structure my whole life, really. Yeah. That it's like, I have a lot to give to the world, but I'm not going to be able to give to the world if I have an empty cup, ever. If my cup is empty, and I'm like parched, what do I have to give? Absolutely nothing. And so that, I'm not always good at it. I'm much better at it than I used to be. Sometimes I just suck. And that's just how it is. But
so funny you would use the word strategy, your strategy, because that's what they call it in human design. The way to respond is my human design strategy. It's like my type's strategy for how you're supposed to approach. Yeah. How you're supposed to make decisions. Yeah.
That's very interesting.
How you said
Well,
that.
I also make speedy decisions sometimes, and I find myself encouraging myself to reserve judgment on lots of things.
Yeah.
Because so there's always more information coming.
What made you, and we got to wrap up because we've been talking a while, but I still have more to ask. What made you go on a retreat across the world? Because like I said, it was your second. I had gone to one with Natanya in Greece 2.5 years ago. And then I went to Thailand. And so I know you've been to Bali. Did you do Bali with her?
I went to Bali and then I went to Costa Rica and then Thailand.
Okay. So this is your third. So what prompted you, if you think back, I mean, I guess you could go for different reasons to the different ones, but what was it about getting away and going somewhere far that you wanted?
Well, it was, I mean, partially it was right after the pandemic. So there was that. But also, I had just started kind of coming into my own in this career, and I was getting more financially stable, because even though I've made lots of money throughout my life, my upbringing has taught me to believe in scarcity. And so, you know, I still, that's one of my challenges, to navigate my finances in a healthy way. But I just started making enough money that I can be comfortable and I can do some traveling and whatever. And I actually hadn't been out of the country since I was 10 or something like that, when I went to England with my parents. I joined Yogi Flight School, actually, which you are also a part of, I think.
Yes, I met Nat in through our businesses, and right. I had her come on the podcast, and then she gifted me Yogi Flight School. So I came in a different way. Yes. Yeah. And I went to a retreat before I really ever participated in any kind of yoga. I just like never had a yoga class with her until I went to Greece, and now I'm hooked. So yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
What did the retreats give you in hindsight? Was it what you expected, or was it more than what you expected?
I really didn't know what to expect. I guess this also goes back to me knowing myself and to structure things, because not only am I an introvert, I also have social anxiety, which most people would never be able to tell because it's all, you know, internal. But that's why I always get a private room. That's why I spend a lot of time by myself, so that I have that safe place to come back to. Not everybody needs that stuff, but everybody needs something. And so that's why I was able to travel across, you know, to Bali, which is literally on the other side of the globe. And I mean, literally in the way that it's designed to be used, just saying, literally on the other side of the globe. I felt like I could still be at home because I took that safety with me, that like my place of safety is internal, that I take it with me wherever I go. And I think that's the biggest thing that I got out of the retreats, is the knowledge that I'm capable of doing that wherever I am, because I know I can, you know, go around the US or like go various places, but that I could travel by myself for 2 weeks or whatever to the, on the other side of the globe, it made me see that I could do that. So that's one of the biggest things that I got. And then the other is just connecting with so many amazing people like yourself. I mean, we would never have met.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. So random. So I think that even though I'm an introvert and even though I have social anxiety, the most profound thing to me is connection. And yes. I love that that is something that has been gifted to me by those retreats.
Yeah. The connection to me is unmatchable, I guess, is how it kind really of how is. I feel. So what do you want to do more of in your second half? You're coming up on a big birthday. In December,
really
is that
excited.
When it is, did you say?
December, yeah. I will be 50 in December. One of the biggest things, I mean, I am already living a life. I'm going to keep living this life for sure. But also with my jewelry brand, I have decided that I'm going to be the model for it, which I think is kind of ballsy for a 50-year-old woman to decide that she's going to be the model for her own jewelry brand. And I'm actually making myself a chainmail dress right now that I'm going to wear in one of the photo shoots. Like, it's just.
You're making a chainmail dress?
Yes.
Oh my gosh. If people don't know what it, I didn't know what chainmail was until I saw the rings you made.
Yeah. It's tiny rings.
Yeah.
Tiny,
yeah,
tiny
so
rings
cool.
Woven together.
Yeah.
So
wow.
For example, like I am going to be as adventurous as I possibly can, and as long as I can maintain my safety wherever I am, which I know that I can do if I'm careful. I mean, obviously I have. So I'm very excited about
taking your adventurous or adventureness into your business. I like that. You're adventuring into your business.
Yeah, my new brand is not rolled out yet, but it's chainmail, and it's called Unchained, and the tagline is Free Yourself.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I'm very excited.
And did this
that.
Stuff come from just exploration of more of your internal
Yes. And the other thing that I discovered, it relates to the if I could just work hard enough, something that I discovered as an artist, and I think as a human, but particularly with my jewelry, there are times where I have to sit and stare at it. I just have to stare at it. And I used to not allow myself to do that because it was wasting time. But I have found that that's where I come up with all my ideas. If I just swoosh things aside as much as I can, and I just sit and stare at it and be with it and look at it and see what it wants to say to me and see what comes up for me. Sometimes nothing happens and sometimes magic happens. But if I didn't do that, magic would never happen. And so I discovered that was the big shift. The big shift is that I have to sit still and be with it, whatever it is. And
Yeah.
that's where the answers come.
Yeah. I love that. I love that. So, what would you like to leave a listener with who is feeling like, oh my gosh, she's so brave? I mean, I feel like they're going to feel that you're brave, that you just have taken chances coming from where you came. I think you'd say, well, that was the only choice I had at the time, probably, knowing you. But you've gone from very structured to unstructured, and then back to structured, and then to unstructured. So I feel like you're just open to everything, which is really a wonderful place to be, and, open to exploring more of who you are and what's possible for you. And I love that you said, because you wrote that, and when you filled out the guest booking information about everything as an opportunity, essentially. I love that. And I wish more people thought of that, because I think people cut themselves off to opportunities by staying small and staying like saying no to too many things. And if just they could say yes to more things. And when you say yes to things, you learn so much more about yourself.
Absolutely. And to answer your question about what I would leave your listeners with, because you said they will think that you're brave about me. And my response to that is, so are you. So
Oh.
are you. You are as brave as I am. We are all brave. It's just a matter of choosing to call that up, call that forth. So are you. Just as brave. And the other thing, yeah, I believe there's value and opportunity in everything. I do not think that everything happens for a reason, not at all. But I do think that there's value and opportunity in everything. I don't know why
Yes,
things happen.
I like that. I
I
like
don't
that.
know why things happen, but I do know that I have a choice. When things happen, what am I going to do? Like I know people who have lost a child. I have lost so many people. Not a child, but I have lost people, I've lost pets. I don't know why those things happen. I don't think they happen for a reason, but I am telling you with 100% certainty that they happen, and then I have a choice to find the value and find the opportunity, and that gives me freedom ultimately.
Yeah, it reminds me of this analogy I've used in the past, is that I've heard people say, well, I've got to play the hand I was dealt, if you're using a game of cards as analogy. But I choose to think that you can draw a new card. There's the game where you're like, I don't like this card, I want to get another card. And so to me, that's kind of like the same thing as everything happens for a reason. Yeah, everything happens for a reason. Maybe if you think I got this hand and I got to play it, but no, it's find a different reason, find a different card. So I like that analogy, because we all have choice.
Yes.
And if you don't like the reason, or that you think there's some reason that doesn't fit with what you want or what you deserve, then find a different reason. Pick another
Yeah. Well,
card.
I've wasted a lot of time on why. Why? Why? Why have things happened? Why are things this way? And I think that there is not as much value in that. Maybe things happen for a reason, maybe they don't, but I don't have that information. So there's no value in it for me. I have the information right now about where the opportunity is or where the value is. And if I don't have that information, I can just pay attention and be with it and sit still, which is not always easy. But that's information that I have right now. That's actionable stuff. That's not, why did it happen? Maybe we can figure it out. Well, I don't know. Maybe that will come. maybe closure will come. I have learned like why things happened in hindsight, but that didn't ever help me in the moment.
Yeah.
Ever. The only yeah. thing that ever helped me in the moment is, what can I do right now? One of my mentors always used to say to me, yeah, honey, a lot of really bad things have happened to you, but you're the one left holding the bag. So
I love that. I love
me
that.
Too.
Reminded me of the saying of like, when you don't like somebody, instead of giving them the poison, you're drinking the poison or something like that. I'm probably
absolutely
not doing that justice. But anyways, yeah, I love the whole thing that you said about trying to figure out why, and yeah, just move on. Don't worry about that. Because I also heard a good saying, I love American Idol, and I've heard it before, but you know, sometimes things just resonate with you again. And Jelly Roll was the mentor, and he told somebody who is all worried about all the mistakes they've made, that's why the windshield is bigger than the rear view mirror.
Yes.
I love that
I
too.
I don't watch American Idol, and I've never heard that. I love that so much.
There's a really good class this season. I'm loving them. So anyways, all right. Well, thank you. We've gone almost an hour. So thank you so much for sharing all your wisdom and your story. And it was so amazing to meet you. And I hope we stay in touch. We've been, of course, chatting with the whole group that went. It was just a great group of people. I tremendously had a fantastic time, and am finding myself often in thoughts of things that we did and what I wished I did more of. Yeah. Looking in that rearview mirror.
It really was magical. And it's been an honor to be with you today.
Aww,
Thank you so much for having me.
All righty. Okay. Bye.